We'll synchronize ourselves here. This should be an Olympic event.
Synchronized recording.
This is Soren Johnson, designer of Civilization 3 and 4, and like me, you're listening to Polycast, the official podcast of Appalton Civilization site.
Welcome to episode 25 of Polycast, the official podcast of Appalton Civilization site. In case anyone was wondering, it's just Solver and I doing a quick introduction here. I managed to convince him to come back very briefly to do this introduction. He managed to do two episodes in one, and we didn't even realize it.
Yeah, that's a problem.
Well, see, I thought about putting everything into episode 24, but...
Well, it's probably better this way. People can always not listen to one of those, or both of those.
You just can't get enough. Mackie isn't even here to tell me not to sing. I hear Mackie's out on a double date.
Wow. Ming and Ra?
Imran's probably reading Harry Potter. Better let me know that the cast itches. So, no, wait. We weren't supposed to talk about that. And, you know, I figured for sure as soon as we started recording this, you would get your phone call. I don't know. What's their problem? You're supposed to call. Interrupt the recording. The phone always rings.
This time you can hear about Soren Johnson's perspective on game design and things to avoid if you are a game designer.
We also go into the Polycast vault. Try not to get too scared. We go back to episode 9 from the modcast where we talk about our favorite Civilization game to date. From episode 23, also in the modcast, we look at a list of what life would be like if it reflected Civilization 4.
Also, we have part 3 of the interview with Greg Hildebrand, who designed the posters for Civ 4 Gold.
All right, news time!
Woohoo!
What is that buzzing sound?
That would be Ming's microphone.
I haven't solved that problem yet.
Ah.
I thought maybe he was keeping the teleporter for Minga Palooka warmed up.
Soren's 8 things not to do in game design.
I really like this list.
Don't make Civ 3. Oh. Was that not on there?
Parts 1 and 2. We did talk about part 1 in a previous episode, but we cut it for time mostly. I actually have snippets of points summarized by Garrett Sidzaka.
Hardcore game conventions.
Oh, yeah.
If you think that you're following a convention and that's detracting from the fun of the game to follow the rules, you shouldn't follow those rules. You shouldn't be mainstream if you think that in any way detracts the fun.
I think it's true. I think making it too hard, like a restrictive save system or something like that, would just frustrate people who want to actually enjoy the atmosphere.
I think it raises a good point there that you just have to offer flexibility because everybody has a different gaming experience. Some of us want it as hard as possible. Some people like it really easy so they can just sit there and romp and stomp for the entire time. And I mean, it really depends on what the gamers are looking for.
That point probably isn't mostly about FPS games, because FPS designers typically make pretty good variety of difficulty levels. You don't really see any FPS game with less than 3 difficulties, and you get upwards to 6 sometimes.
Mm.
The other genres, developers sometimes omit difficulty levels altogether, or they add things that completely do not fit in. Like, they make an FPS game and suddenly in the middle of it, it turns into a jump platform game, some variation of Mario in 3D.
Yeah, I think there's just some kinds of challenges that just don't work. They don't really offer a real challenge, it's just more monkey work. So I think when you're making a hard game and trying to offer a challenge, you have to be a little bit more creative than just say, you have 3 lives and we're going to make it damn impossible to learn how to play this game on the later levels because you only have 1 life left. I think most games have gotten rid of that.
Yeah, or you just have 5 minutes. Yeah, timer limits aren't very fun either.
The Tomb Raider games come to mind. They were pretty beautifully made, but, well, this largely has to do with ancient technology that they used. But all puzzles generally required you to do some things that do not make sense. you take some Egyptian symbol, you put it on a wall, you combine it with something absolutely else, you shoot it, and then the puzzle is solved. It's only in the last 2 or 3 years, maybe, that games started creating puzzles that actually make sense, you know, using real-world physics, using approaches that you could use in real life instead of something that is totally cuckoo.
It does kind of help when it does make sense.
Yeah, there was at some point, I think it was around Tomb Raider 3 or so, and they just upped the difficulty level on where they would hide things. You almost had to have a guide to play the game to know where to jump.
Oh, yeah.
Ridiculous.
Oh, please, you'd only play Tomb Raider to watch Laura jump.
Yeah, that's what Maka does all the time. I'm sure.
I think a form of challenge that's easy to get behind because it suits casual gamers and hardcore gamers equally is to have a game with a lot of optional content. Some people frown on this because they feel like it makes a short or easy game sometimes, but if there's a game where half of the game can be discovered if you're hardcore enough to explore it, I think it's a great way to offer that extended experience to people who want it.
Designers don't often have enough guts to do that, because if they hide half the content, they will have to face a lot of people who say, oh, the game was short, I beat it in 4 hours, where the hell was everything, what did I pay for?
Yeah, that's a fair point.
Something to keep in mind, at any rate, for game designers. The repetitive interface tasks.
He was mentioning an old role-playing game where you'd have to hit X on every single item to sell it, and it would take a half hour just to get rid of some junk. I believe some people were making fun of that statement in the forums, saying, Shift-Enter, 3,800 BC, Shift-Enter, 3,700 BC. You get it, Shift-Enter, 3,600 BC. So he got a little bit of flack there.
To be quite honest, sometimes a great game is ruined by a poor interface, where you can enjoy a game doing something that is incredibly annoying. To enjoy that game tends to devalue the experience.
Yeah, there's not much to say about it. If a simple task that the player has to do lots of times requires more than 2 mouse clicks, then you have a problem.
I'm going to go a step further. I actually feel pretty strongly about this as somebody who loves Civilization. I hate a lot of real-time strategy because I feel like the opening few moves of the game are just so repetitive but so important. And getting that barracks built before anybody else is a matter of having your hotkeys timed just right so that way everything works out beautifully. I don't think that's fun. I don't think that's particularly fair or interesting. I think a lot of RTS games would be better off if they just started you with a barracks or made this sort of twitch timing thing less important.
Actually, many games do have that option, but for some reason players prefer not to use them. I guess RTS players are just the kind that actually enjoy the speed, they want the timing, they are very happy. I beat my record today, I got a barrack after 1 minute and 8 seconds, wonderful.
Yeah, I don't know, that doesn't sound like a strategy game to me, that sounds like...
It's not.
No, not really.
I've always had a problem with the name real-time strategy. Strategy is a long-term thing. Those games are real-time tactics. There are lots of tactics in there and very, very little strategy.
And too much emphasis on timing and speed and not enough on smarts, I think.
Yeah.
Would an exception to that rule, in the sense that RTS, an RTS title actually resembling strategy, would be in the form of Rise of Nations?
Yes, but only if you play it in single player. In a single player, it's wonderful. You can pause, you can give orders, execute flanking maneuvers. As soon as you go online, of course, there is no pause feature of online. But you'll notice that your opponents will not do those things. They will play it just like every other RTS. They will rush, they will create lots of units, and all that thinking, it remains in the design document.
Ah, yes. Good point.
That's my pessimistic outlook, you could say.
I just really hate build orders. I think build orders are pretty stupid. They kind of annoy me. When you find that one optimal build order and just do it every single time, that to me, that's a repetitive interface that needs to be done away with.
Yeah, and an idea I have that could possibly fix that, I know someone will steal it, is to start the game with random building costs. For example, when you start the game, you don't know how much a barracks will cost and how much something else will cost. Those costs would be not only randomly determined as to how much they cost, but also what they cost. It could be wood, it could be stone, Most games have 4 or 5 basic resources. And that would really shake the game up, because every player would be forced to adapt.
See, to me that sounds like fun. I think there's a lot of people who wouldn't like that, though, but hopefully there's an audience for something like that, however.
Three is limited play variety.
This is actually what me and Dan Teachers talked about, probably the biggest fault of all RTS games, that even if they do offer the variety, players will narrow it down, players tend to find some settings that create confrontation in the biggest amount, that do not require long games, that will take 40 minutes or an hour, so and thus the play variety is really, really limited.
There's nothing worse than spending a lot of money on a game and being done with it in a week.
Yeah.
Fortunately, that isn't a problem with Civ.
You need to find ways to extend replayability. Multiplayer is a great way to do that because real opponent will offer you so many different experiences. Another way to offer variety is to offer customization. When people can customize it, you can extend the life of a game indefinitely.
Mm-hmm.
But other than that, it comes down to just good game design. Yeah. You got to have a game that offers some interesting decisions, so that way you can play through the game a couple times doing a couple different things.
And as far as customization goes, Rise of Nations is definitely a good example. When you start a new game, you have an absolutely amazing number of options. Compare that to the example that Soren uses, Company of Heroes.
You mentioned being an excellent tactical real-time strategy, but that there was no way to have more replay value with different setups. It was just very limited after you were done playing it.
Whereas Rise of Nations, well, I think it offered more than a dozen different options to change. Well,
that's one of the nice things about mods, too. I mean, you can take a game and play an entirely different game. That's a nice idea. Works well with Civ. Some of the mods are pretty good.
Yeah, and I think how well a game is perceived in the beginning will determine whether or not anyone will want to take the time and energy to create a mod and in turn extend its replayability. So if there's nothing in the base game to get people going, kind of like the base game needs to inspire those to actually do something with it, because I think if a game is really bad from the beginning, people could say, well, yeah, I could mod it, but is there really an audience for this game to begin with who would even pay attention, even if I created the most brilliant mod ever, EVAR?
Well, that's the thing. If you spend the time to create a mod, you want people to enjoy it. It's kind of worthless to create a mod for a game no one's going to
exactly.
play.
Exactly. Yep.
Soren talks about, like, I guess the Age of Empires series a little bit as well. I mean, I didn't even know that you could have multiple players controlling the same single civilization.
No.
I guess having a game that allows all sorts of weird things that you can do and all sorts of options that you can check or uncheck definitely helps extend, say, a strategy game, you know, well beyond its regular single-player mode, campaign, whatever, lifespan.
To go even further than that, some games are just so deep that people can naturally create their own options. I think Civilization is obviously a great game. And people who got tired of beating it over and over, they invented stuff like the Three City Challenge and Always War.
Or how fast can I get to the stars? You know, Civ 2 we played for years.
Huh.
Keep coming up with new ways to make it interesting.
Fair enough.
Some of us didn't like Civ 3.
You have to bide your time somehow.
When you make a game that deep with multiple victory conditions and so on, there's just so many different things you can do to just artificially create a mod, even without a modding tool. You just say, I'm going to try to play it without ever building a spearman.
I think you've raised a very valuable point there. Many of us have no interest in creating our own mods, but with Civ, there's so many different options, different types of maps you can play. You create your own little scenarios, and you never seem to run out of them.
During Civ 4 development, Firaxis actually looked at what challenges players invented for themselves in Civ 2 and Civ 3. That's why Civ 4 has an actual in-game option for One City Challenge, for Always War, because those are player variations from previous games.
I kind of like the fact that Firaxis picked up the One City Challenge and incorporated it into the game, so we didn't have to just do it on our own.
Too much stuff.
He mentions that some games on the back of the cover of the game will say 18 weapons, 68 monsters, 29 levels, and that's what you're buying. But he thinks that's the bad idea. He says that it should be enough stuff in there to fill your head. And he notes that the magic number of amount of decisions or ideas to juggle at any one time for a gamer is around 12. And that's his number.
I think too much stuff varies dramatically by, again, the gamer himself. Some people really love to have a lot of stuff, whereas others, they're just trying to play it as simply as possible and enjoy the game. So it's a tough balance for somebody to figure out.
Yeah, I mean, if you have a ton of units or something like that in the game, some people might be like, whoa, wait a second, that's too much. What is the difference between this and that? And someone else might be like, no, that's great. Can you use this one on these type of raids and this one on these type of raids?
I think the problem with a lot of adding that many units, though, is it's hard to balance. You can't possibly make a game that with 200-300 units that are all have a solid purpose without any exploits. So I think keeping that number down, it lets you make a game in less than 10 years.
One of the other games in Civ that I've been playing recently is an open source effort for Transport Tycoon. Does anyone remember or play Transport Tycoon? It was released by Microprose in 1994. It's an economic simulation game where the goal is to essentially make as much money as possible and beat out your competitors, if you play with any competitors. Where you're building road vehicles, airplanes, ships, and trains, or any combination thereof. You max out at 200 trains, airplanes, ships, and road vehicles. So you could potentially have 800 vehicles. And depending upon the difficulty levels, you could have quite a micromanagement headache. By default, the units will break down on their age and or based on their reliability, and you have to manually replace each one of those vehicles.
That sounds brutal.
There is no automation. It depends on both who you are and how well it is implemented, because it is possible to implement 15 things poorly and 15 things well, or at least passable.
Yeah, I think Soren was deliberately trying to start controversy with this list, which is good. I mean, nobody's really going to argue with, you know, too little stuff. They're going to say, oh yeah, of course, you want to have a deep game. But saying too much stuff, there's a lot of people who don't believe that there's too much. I think a lot always sounds good on paper, but in execution, having that much can often lead to that micromanagement nightmare that you just talked about, or where you have that one killer unit that you didn't realize existed because you're trying to balance 200 different units, and now you end up with this one thing that totally ruins the game because it makes the game so easy.
I mean, how many units in Civ have been nerfed after they figured out that they just didn't think that through clearly?
Half the units in the game?
Only.
At Civ, a lot of people don't even think that there's a lot of units. I think there's something like 35 or 40 military units, which sounds like a lot to me, but to other people isn't very much. And there's already a lot of balance issues just right there. Imagine if they doubled that.
Well, when you think about it, though, in Civ, even though they have a lot of military units, they're all the same type, and they just advance with age. You have a lot of different types of infantry units, a lot of different types of artillery. So in reality, while there may be a lot of units, you're never dealing with all 35 types at one time.
That's also a good point. A lot of games with a lot of stuff, they can naturally organize it by time, by type, and it makes the game easier to learn. It also makes the game easier for the developer to balance, because they see that each unit has a role, and they want it to fit that role. So already ahead of time, they can figure out what target they're aiming for when they're designing the game.
Yeah, and I much prefer the idea of 35 to 40 units with promotions, for example, as opposed to having 60 to 70 units, but no promotions.
Yeah, that's a great...
Promotions was a nice feature.
There's this problem of expansions. It's very tempting for developers to create an expansion which does not really change anything about the game, which just piles stuff on, and then you can sell it easily. You can say, we have this many more units, we have this many more maps. The result is average at best.
Yeah, you know, Beyond the Sword is a different experience, and I like it for what it is, but there's a part of me that feels like there's too many wonders right now. They've almost lost their meaningfulness.
Yeah, it's very good that Beyond the Sword introduced new technologies, mainly it's the aesthetics early technology, because otherwise you would have wonder for every technology in the early game, and that is simply not acceptable.
Well, when you think about it, though, Beyond the Sword was meant for just that. It was meant as a builder's game. I mean, Warlord was out there for us hardcore, let's kill anything that moves people, and BTS really brings in the builder's experience. So while I feel there's too much to build in it, I'd prefer to be a warrior instead of a classic builder. But for the builders, a lot of good things are being said about it. They really like option to be able to race to a lot of different wonders. So not my particular style, but a lot of people do like that.
Yeah, but it's interesting. Warlords was an expansion for war people, but Warlords added two new units, but three new wonders all the same, I think, right?
Well, again, I think it's a matter of what they thought the release was supposed to do. Warlords really was meant for the hardcore wargamers and actually was a great version for the MP community. Whereas BTS, they just add so much to it, but it's really appropriate for the SP builder.
Yeah, I think this too much stuff question comes down to taste. It comes down to personal style. Too much stuff is going to vary from game to game. It really depends on your audience, so you have to know that audience well. And a game like Civ that has like 1 or 2 million buyers, I think, you have to be aware that having too little stuff in or too much stuff could really jeopardize that loyal audience.
That is one problem. When you have a popular game, you're really designing the game for the middle audience. And how many people really fill in that middle audience? How many people are on either end of the spectrum?
The problem with audience is that there are many fringe groups. There are people who will always fight and never build. There are single-player, multiplayer people. The amount of groups is horrible, and you just can't please anyone, no matter what you do.
Well, you definitely can't please everyone, that's for sure.
Remember when the Holy Roman Empire was announced? A certain forum had, I think, about 20 threads at one time. Why the Holy Roman Empire? They're not at Civ. Well, there are some other topics that tend to repeat themselves every 2 weeks. So you have lots of those unhappy people, too.
You just had to bring up the Holy Roman Empire.
Yeah.
Of course he did.
The Holy Roman Empire is a perfect example of how more is not always a good thing.
Unless you run Civ websites, in which case there's plenty of discussion on it. With Civ 4, as we were getting on in other episodes, for people who think that there is too much stuff, right in the game setup, there's the options, for example, no vassal states for Warlords. I don't want that. No random events that Beyond the Sword introduce. I don't want that. So there is some measure so that you can get people on both extremes happy as well as targeting towards the middle crowd.
Yeah.
That's a good point. And for the really hardcore people who are going to listen to a polycast and so on and so forth, you have customization. You have people who can make really killer mods that double the amount of content. And, you know, that might not appeal to the mainstream or quote-unquote middle gamer, but for people like us, we're into it.
And that's the thing, a good game will be able to play to every end of the spectrum. Civ does a good job of that, and so do some of the other games. At least we're not being forced to play the one way they want us to play. That's what I hate when I buy a game.
Scary thing, he just put the first four on there, and then he has the list of what is the next four that are coming of the worst things in game design. And one of the four categories that's coming up is modders. Oh, no.
Protecting codes and data. I think in some ways, Lauren is very right, that if you release a lot of that code and data and all that sort of thing, you get a lot of fun and different types of mods that really can keep a life of a game going for a long time. By having all of this stuff, he points out with Beyond the Sword, you have Fall from Heaven, you have Rise and Fall of Civilization, World War II, Road to War, and different mods that really take advantage of the innards that have been released, and that really can keep people coming back for more over and over.
It's just really overrated to think that if you build a fortress around your code that you're actually benefiting yourself. A lot of great games came from customization. One of my favorite games of all time was Counter-Strike, which is 100% built by modders.
Oh, see, I just don't see any upside to hiding the code. That's why it's kind of an interesting point. It's like there's really no benefit. If you're just so paranoid you don't want to get it out, you're taking away the ability for anybody to take it to the next step. And that's kind of silly, actually.
What Firaxis did with Civ 4, it's a very important thing for the whole industry. Because in the strategy genre, you don't really have any companies who release source code for their games. In shooters, it first began with ID, who released source for their Doom and Doom 2. Sometime after release, I think a couple of years, but still. And then there was Half-Life in 1998, in which the source was released. But for strategy games, you didn't have any big strategy games with an open source. And I certainly want to hope that Firaxis will show an example that Blizzard and the other big companies will understand that this is the way to go, that they really should release source code.
One of the reasons when he calls out strategy games, and I think one of the problems, there's so many, in real time at any rate, there were so many clones and whatnot, I guess companies were just scared of someone finding out something that they had done really good and taking it and using it in their game. on some respects, maybe a Blizzard or someone like that, although he does talk up Blizzard for having a good editor, might say, well, Civ doesn't really have as much competition in the turn-based fields as maybe they would have with StarCraft III, which you know would have maybe 10 clones coming out of it within, like, a couple of years. I mean, that's the only reason I can think of where people might want to try to hide their code. I don't know if it really helps, but...
Well, not really. Well, once you see the idea, you can still do it in another game. And it's not like you can just take the code from one game and put it into another directly. If you were really good, you don't have to worry about copycats in the end.
Yeah, people could copy an idea just by looking at it.
Exactly.
I think the only exception to that maybe is the AI. But if we had Civ 4 without such an open concept on the AI, we would never have Blake do the fantastic work that he's done. So that's a perfect example.
I mean, the minute a game is released, people are going to be figuring out ways to copy it anyway, so what difference does it make? Let's get serious. In the digital world, nothing can stay hidden for that long, so the best way around that is to heighten the experience and give it away for free. As he says, giving away stuff can feel good. It also feels smart. It just isn't feel smart, it is smart. And Blake is a classic example of that.
That actually ties into the next thing he talks about, too, the anti-piracy paranoia. Now, of course, I'm banning both of them, Hidden Code and Data and the anti-piracy, but it's trusting your fan base. For Axis Inside, they want to trust their fan base and look at what has occurred as a result.
It is a great change of direction, because with Civ 3, Mike Breitkreutz said that he doesn't believe in scripting languages because they only give people the power to create bugs. That sort of attitude that is not really productive. If you don't believe your fans can create something worthwhile, it benefits no one in the end.
Number 6?
Yeah, anti-piracy paranoia.
Yay, Stardock.
Yay.
Boo, slightly irrational.
Yeah, I think this kind of goes back to what we were just talking about being a little bit less protective. We all agree that piracy can be a problem, and we're not saying that people should give away these games for free. But how far are you willing to go to stomp out piracy? Are you willing to go so far that you make the game unplayable for the people who actually do pay for it? It's just not worth it sometimes.
Yeah, there's that problem right now with the PC version of BioShock because it has Securom on there, and people are having problems when sometimes it doesn't uninstall properly and you use up one of your two available install slots, and then what happens if the other one borks up? What happens 4 or 5 years in a row when the support company's not there to help you unstuck it?
Yeah. In response to that, 2K Games decided to increase it to 5 times you can install it because there was such an outcry about it. I guess they do know that their fan base isn't really happy about it, but I guess they're not willing to really change all that
much. Yeah, but still, okay, they boosted it to 5 installations. But what's the point? If you know anything about computer science, you will realize that any protection can be cracked given a sufficient amount of time. In fact, I believe that BioShock also has cracked. Then, in the end, pirates, they receive a better product.
Mm-hmm.
Pirates don't have to worry about keeping their disk in the drive. They don't have to worry about limited activations or installations or what have you. So, if you really go too much with those strong anti-piracy measures, you are just encouraging people to try pirated versions.
Well, in the old joke in marketing, the number one rule they teach us is don't piss off your customers.
Yeah, that's common sense.
It's that simple. And again, I think to the point that was just made, most of the anti-piracy stuff isn't going to stop anybody in the long run. And all they're doing is pissing off the people who are actually paying for the game.
Yeah, exactly.
Not a smart idea.
Like Soren points out, with LAN multiplayer games, really their unofficial policy for Civ 4 was if you spread around during LAN games, you can expose new people to Civ that may not have played it. Some guy shows up and is like, hey, let's play Civ 4, and the other guy doesn't really know much about it, or at least the fourth game or something like that. Maybe they played 2 or something back in the day. It helps expose people to Civ, but I guess a lot of companies don't want you to pass around the disc for a LAN party or whatever. It tends to lessen the enjoyment, and, of course, the person might end up playing the game less anyway because they can't do things like that.
My place is a classic example. I've got 6 computers set up for BTS. The disc gets passed around, and I'll bet you I've sold probably 15 copies to other people who have tried it, played it, and said, hey, this is great. I want to be able to play with you guys from my own home.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Mm.
So, in a way, I'm one of their best salespeople. If they made me pay for that disc every time, you think I'd have six machines set up in my basement?
Well, you know, something a little bit more controversial than that. I actually think that pirates are pretty influential people when it comes to the internet and so on. And sometimes it's actually really good to have a couple people playing your game who maybe didn't pay for it, but they set the taste, they set the opinion for so many people. You might actually benefit more in the long run.
Well, when you always see the threads, because we have it, of course, on our site, basically a policy that we don't support piracy at all, so we kill all links. But whenever the discussion is there, the average gamer, the person that everybody's trying to really get, they say, hey, I don't mind if I sample the game, and if I like it, I'm going to go out and buy it. And that's usually the case in most cases, because the demos suck. So if people find pirated copies of the game, they try it. If they like it, they'll go out and pay for it, because basically we're honest people mostly.
At least with console games, you can rent them and try it before you buy it and not waste $40 on something that you're going to finish in 3 days.
That's a good point.
Speaking of consoles, I'm a big fan of console games. I grew up on Nintendo, and part of what their strategy was to stick with cartridges because they would be harder to copy, and it turned out to be a death knell for them. PlayStation really did well off of CDs, and I would say that piracy was a part of that. It kind of partially helped them sell more systems and sell more games.
Dan T, I'm afraid I'm going to have to drop you from the call now because you said you like consoles. That's a shame.
I'm not ashamed of my love of consoles.
I like consoles too. We all grew up on consoles. Come on.
Dan Q, I like consoles too.
I don't.
My first game of Civ was on a console, Nintendo.
Ah.
Shame on you.
Yes.
That made me go out and buy a computer so I could play the real game.
Hey, you are talking to the guy who runs the Civ Rev part of the site poorly. Oh, someone posted in the Civ Rev forum yesterday.
Holy crap.
Woo! I might have something to do.
Did? Boot, boot. Was it you?
No, it was a guy named Cookie Monster.
Was it spam?
The big thread on the Civ Rev forums is Snoopy saying, why can't we get Civ Rev on the PC?
Thank God you can.
And I guess most of us are saying, why do you want, like, the half game on your PC?
Maybe because he thinks there's too much stuff on it.
Let's go to Black Box Mechanics.
This is a point relating closely to number 5, because if you release your source code, you can't have Black Box Mechanics. We often have people asking with Civ 4 questions like, how is your holy city determined, how exactly is combat resolved, and so on. And since you have the Civ 4 code, you can explain to them exactly every detail of every game aspect with as much depth as they can comprehend. Imagine how much it would suck to play Civ 4 without knowing half of the rules, in essence. Civ 3 corruption model, it was very complex, and we had a debate on Apolliton for months, I think, about how does it really work. And it was not until Alex Matsaris figured it all out that corruption became actually understood.
Yeah, I consider myself a pretty hardcore gamer. I like to play to be the best, but I find I feel my way through a game at first. I'm not really looking at those numbers. I'm trying to get a feel for what works and what doesn't without necessarily calculating. And only if I really love the game, then I actually care enough to learn percentages and formulas. You need to have them out there because it just makes your game more playable. It extends the life of the game for people who want to have that hardcore experience.
And if it's a visual medium, you'd see me nodding.
Number 8, he says this is the most controversial point, and I completely disagree with him on it.
It is a controversial point. I think that's good, though. I think it's good to arouse discussion with these things. It would be easy to say, have a good story. It's much more controversial to say, maybe there's such a thing as too much story, or a story that's in the wrong places, even if it's good.
Well, I know what he's talking about, but he also says he doesn't like, basically, stories in his game at all. And I don't know, I think that's kind of silly. Games like, say, StarCraft or Blizzard's games have really had an in-depth story, and I think that's really helped them, especially getting players engaged in the game, in all the story. I played World of Warcraft for a little bit, and all of the story that arises from the 3 Warcraft games that's inside of the game world and all this lore back there, a lot of players are very into it and very interested in it, and I think it keeps them coming back for more. Yes, Blizzard has a reputation for doing extremely well-done games, but I think also the story tends to perhaps hide flaws or something like that, and I buy a lot of games for the story. I thought that Smack was one of the greatest Civ games because of that story behind it.
I think that's because the story added to the game. The story was a part of the game, and it wasn't just something to keep you moving along. It was integral to how you played the game, how you felt about the game. It really got you involved in the game. There's a classic example of how to do it right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think if Soren's saying that, you know, story shouldn't be done, I hope he's not saying that, because that's just not right. But I think story should be something that you experience as opposed to something that you watch. Like, a good cutscene is good, but having too much of that to the point where you're not even playing the game anymore, you might as well be just watching a long movie with a couple clicks in between.
Mm-hmm.
When you can actually have somebody playing through the game, playing through the story. One thing that I really liked about StarCraft was actually on the map you had these little characters talking sometimes between these extended moments of action. It draws you in a way that cutscene doesn't.
Yeah, like when it comes to cutscenes, at the peril of once again mentioning the dark master of all game publishers, Electronic Arts. You mentioned Alpha Centauri already, which of course we know they publish and own the rights to, and that's a whole other topic. But they also publish the Need for Speed series. They started introducing stories with Need for Speed Most Wanted and then Need for Speed Carbon, and it was interesting, but what was annoying was the cheesy dialogue and the cutscenes that you couldn't click through, which made me just want to go back to the sandbox mode, which was enjoyable, and I will admit that the stories actually got me to purchase and actually start playing these later titles, but the same stories...
They were done so bad.
Well, the story was good. It was just the really poor execution in some cases with the cutscenes that were appropriately placed, but it's like I got the point in the first 10 or 15 seconds. Why are they still talking a minute later? I really don't care.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas a game that I think does cutscenes quite well, and I can only speak to one specific title because it's the one that's on PC, Halo Combat Evolved. And that has a story in there, and those were really well done in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, do it right or don't do it.
Pretty much.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what we take from it, but I think Soren went a little bit farther if you look at what he wrote.
Yes.
He's like, I don't like story in games.
He doesn't like stories in games. That's simple.
Yeah, he doesn't like stories in games. It depends. I mean, look at what Half-Life did for the first-person shooter genre. Just by adding an interesting and amazing story on top of a great gameplay experience.
On the flip side, though, I used to be a big fan of the Final Fantasy series, but I found that the games started to become more and more like an interactive movie, and it just lost its appeal for me. I speak personally. I know there's a lot of people who still love the Final Fantasy series, but I think that's an example of going too far.
Well, I agree with you.
I also agree with that one.
The earlier ones were great. The later ones, it was just like, oh joy, what do I have to do next?
What big boss thing do you want me to fight before the next cutscene?
Exactly.
Mm, yeah, so I think we all kind of have somewhat of an agreement, but a little less forceful than Soren.
Yeah.
Yes.
Just a little.
We like Soren.
Yeah, I think there's a middle ground between what Soren's saying and what some of these other games are doing.
Yeah.
Hopefully you don't have to kill all story.
Yeah, do it right or, yeah, don't necessarily try.
No. Do it right or just don't do it, please.
There are some games, actually, that decided to do away with the story entirely, like going back to an FPS, I guess, it's called Serious Sam. It was just a shooter. It was like, we don't have a story. You know, you just shoot stuff. And it was insanely popular and did it well. So when you realize that you don't really have a good story or you know you won't be doing a good story, it might help just to focus on gameplay.
So some of my favorite games from back in the day when I was a kid, they didn't have much of a good story at all. And in fact, like a lot of these like elaborate cutscenes could be really just replaced with a deep voice saying, "The world sucks. Blow stuff up." That's usually the story for a lot of these games.
And I'm guessing that Soren is not a role-playing game player.
Definitely not.
Oh, no.
Obviously not.
I'm still sad that we lost Soren to Maxis. I'm happy because I'm excited to play Spore now. But
I think Spore is going to be the game, though.
Hmm, you think it'll be the game, huh? Would you like to go do a Spore podcast now? I'll let you. I think it's somehow appropriate to end this Soren discussion by addressing a question that one Jose Octavio Dittman asked, Soren, which is Spore a sequel of the early 90s game Sim Earth? Don't even joke about that. That's not fair. Got news? Send a private message to Dan Q, Locutus, Snoopy369, Alexander the First, or Illuminatus via Golden's Worms. You have entered the vault where segments cut from earlier episodes find relevance later. From Episode 9's Modcast with Dan Q, Makalua, Imran, and Blake Walsh, recorded on February 17th, 2007.
This Civ game. I prefer Civ City Rome.
Oh.
Civ 4 is really cleaning up there, though. 68.5%. With Alpha Centauri in second at 19.10% in the poll. And, of course, since it's listed in the Civ 4 General Forum, this might be a little unfair.
Biased.
But I still think Civ 4 would win by a good margin. I mean, I really loved Alpha Centauri and all the story elements and the alien world and, you know, all of the different personalities and everything. But Civ 4 just is generally a better game in terms of all the gameplay additions. My best wish would be, if possible, of course it probably isn't, to have Alpha Centauri 2 taking a lot of the advances in gameplay from Civ 4 and putting, you know, the story, the alien world, the different factions based ideology and things like that together. And there are a few things that I still like about Alpha Centauri better, such as the way they do their UN, you know, Galactic Council, or whatever the hell it was called.
Planetary
Council, compared to the UN as it exists in Civ at this moment, and all of the story aspects.
Yeah, I too really enjoyed the story elements in Alpha Centauri, and I'd like to see that come back in some fashion. As you said, perhaps in an Alpha Centauri 2.
Hey, you have to talk to EA about that.
Stupid EA.
Yes, evil EA.
And here's my problem, though. Two people voted for Civ 3. Civ 3?
Can we find out
are you serious?
Are and mock them?
Well, easy now, Imran. Their machine might not be able to handle Civ 4.
That could be
true. It's where they can't play it. Mm. Too delusional.
Yeah, Civ 2 is still better than Civ 3.
Yeah.
And
Quarterpad 2 is equal to Civ 3.
Two people voted for Call to Power 2, and one voted for Call to Power 1. Who are these crazy people?
Wouter could be one.
Today. Nuts.
But yeah, I would agree Civ 4 as well. I think we need to emphasize not just the incorporation of religion in the base game, but now we can talk about the addition of vassal states brought by the Warlords expansion. Come on, that's just excellent.
Excellent. It's not like they're completely useless or something.
We often see it debated whether Civ 4 sacrificed too much in terms of the ease of modding with how much you can mod. It's like, well, yes, you can mod a lot of stuff, but it's not terribly easy, at least as compared to earlier Civ games. And I think there is that imbalance, but surely that was a wise move on Firaxis' part, because I think it's easier to build systems and mechanisms around known resources. You can actually go into the game, you can actually get easy access to the stuff, than trying to have to find or even substitute instead to try to work around the fact that you can't get access. Now, of course, I say that because I'm not the ones that have to try to make it easier to mod, but that's okay. I'm the ideas man, and everybody knows that.
Uh-oh, if you're the ideas man.
We're in trouble.
Crap, I thought I was the ideas man.
I like the fact that it is more difficult to mod now because it actually does affect the quality of the mods to the better. Because somebody has to really dig in and really be dedicated to what they're doing to put a mod together. They don't just throw together some weird idea and go, look! Because I've been places and I've seen a few things and I go, and you did this, why? But back to the original topic, I and Blake have the same problem. Don't make us choose.
Yes.
Don't make you choose. So they're all winners, is what you're saying.
They're all winners in my book.
Civ 4 and Alpha Centauri.
That one's a winner.
Yes. Though, Civ 4 did make Yin eat a box. So it might get the slight edge on that.
Although I'll bet one of the people who voted for Alpha Centauri was Andrew R. Galloway, because he does say, quote, it is easier to rationalize killing anonymous life forms at Alpha Centauri than it is killing Zulus in Civilization 3.
No, you just think of the Zulus as inferior people. Oh, did I reveal too much?
Or you're me and the Zulus rolled over the tanks in your first game of Civ ever and you've just held this grudge all this time.
Bastards.
From episode 23's Modcast with Dan Q, Umarta Lakutish Snyders, Mark Patella Turtle Anderson, Derek Kale Paxton, and Tony Garrett's Zach Keel, recorded on August 18th, 2007. Things you have learned from Civ Thread. What I did is I went through the thread and I found top 10 things you have learned from Civ.
Nice.
Remember the last time you did a list when I was on the show, Dan? That was horrible.
Lucky you. You get the follow-up now. What we're getting at here, Defiant 47 says, that things in Civ that are the way just because they are or to balance gameplay, but are funny when transported into real life. From Snippafest, bears, lions, pumas, and wolves were all united in an alliance against early man. Number 9, from Anorax, from space, France is blue in color.
I think that one's true.
He also gets the number 8 spot. In the history of the world, there have only been 7 good movies. I think we can all think of those. Italica Guy 10. Units are larger than everything in the game, including the city that has built them and forests. That's true. New York was founded centuries before York was. From Florian. Number 5, I actually came up with one of my own. When warring nations sign a peace treaty, opposing armies typically move out of the other's territory instantly.
Hundreds Woo! Of miles in the blink of an eye. It's amazing.
Defiant 47, number 4, it takes more time to raise a hamlet than to raise a city.
There's a couple mods that have fixed that, turned that around, but it is odd when you think about it.
Just like when you park on a driveway and drive on a parkway, makes you think. From Florian, to this very day, a ship under a Spanish flag will move a little bit faster than an identical ship in the service of another country because Ferdinand Magellan was working for Spain when he circumnavigated the globe.
This is true.
Defiant 47 at number 2, it is possible to be able to use your money to upgrade a war elephant into a gunship, but to be unable to use your money to create a gunship directly. And number 1 on the top 10 things you have learned from Civ, from Snippafist, conquering armies are renowned for their tendency to build theaters in their wake.
Nice.
MP is much more fun because you're playing against somebody with a brain.
I think you'll be hearing from Blake now, Ming. Wow.
It's true. Yeah, we got mail.
And it wasn't spam.
That was the other surprise.
Call in today.
In North America, the number is 301-637-659. 301-637-POLY.
And for Europe, 44-020-7871-7659. 44-020-7871-POLY.
Or you can Skype us at the Polycast.
Seriously, where is the hate mail address?
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
For more information on the show, log on to the official Polycast website at polycast.apolton.net.
Podcast.
Say more quietly.
Yeah, man. Seriously.
How does that?
That's what my freaking keyboard makes, damn it.
The third and final part of our interview with Civilization 4 Gold Edition poster artist Greg Hildebrand.
Time and space are modes by which we think, not conditions in which we live. Albert Einstein.
Well said. Well quoted.
I'm always quoting. I say my studio's lined with quotes, which I put up, I read something, I throw it up on the wall. The man who has no imagination has no wings. Muhammad Ali. I stick them up on my walls. I use them. I'll walk in the morning, I'll read something, and it's just kind of like, there, I'll live in this space here for the day. So there's no such thing. Time and space.
Well, exactly, because not every 12-year-old boy or girl is going to be interested in the same thing, so how do you possibly measure that?
I have no concept. They don't know what they're talking about. They need to be like me. See, imagination is always the essence of it for me, and that was something that was drummed into my head by my mother. Use your imagination from the year one. That's what it's all about. You go inside, you come outside, you go inside. It's a great life.
Mm-hmm. Now, being a gamer, what's this outside you speak of? I'm not.
Exactly. Well, it's all related, right? I mean, gaming or painting, there's no two ways about it. I do what I do to escape. It's just so much more fun to inhabit yourself in worlds that you invent. You know? You know. Of course you know.
Oh,
of course all the people that play your game know that. Comics are interesting because what realm do they fit in? Science fiction? Fantasy?
Oh, yeah.
They're two of the biggest paintings ever painted. They're 12 feet long for a show on the history of superheroes in comics. This is a big thrill. I'm really enjoying it. Again, it's a huge challenge, so just the logistics of it are interesting.
Yes, and I've heard it's going to be the largest Greg Hildebrandt painting ever.
Yes, two of them, in fact. 24 feet long.
Wow.
It's fun. You know, there's something about painting huge that gives you more of a sense of involvement. There's a kind of like that feeling that you can walk inside of it. That's what I like to try to do, create with pictures, like doing the civilization painting. You put yourself in the scene. You get into it. You're inside of it. You're there. You're on the spot. You involve yourself in it. That's the thrill of it for me. And I felt that every inch of the way on that civilization painting. That's the fun of that kind of painting in art for me.
Mm-hmm. And these two 12-foot paintings, they're going to be in color, are they?
They're full color.
Which company should I buy shares in that makes paint? Because...
Yes. Believe me, we've ordered it by the gallons just about.
If you're listening and you would like to sponsor the show.
Yeah, there you go. There you go.
Now, looking towards Civ again, the second Civ 4 expansion pack, Beyond the Sword, was released shortly after Civ 4 Gold Edition, and that's where we can find your poster, Greg, as part of retail copies of Civ 4 Gold Edition. No pirating out there.
Yeah.
Beyond the Sword includes a mod that is fantasy-based called Fall from Heaven and sci-fi-based Final Frontier. I know you say you don't play computer games, but let's say that you do. This is a vain attempt, by the way, to determine whether your first preference is fantasy or sci-fi-based. Were you to play Beyond the Sword today, which scenario do you believe you'd be more inclined to try first and why?
Oh, jeez. Oh, you put me on the spot. First of all, distinctions like that, I guess, you know, whatever the distinctions sci-fi fantasy are, I mean, it's all under the big umbrella of fantasy to me, or separate reality, or other separate worlds. I don't make any distinction from a Betty Boop drawing and a Michelangelo drawing. They're all on the same page to me. I don't know if that makes sense to you.
Oh, no, sure. What you would like to do is you would like to try both at the same
time. Yes, exactly.
Well, maybe the creators of these two mods can get together and can do that for you.
Hey, and maybe I can paint another picture for you.
There you go. I don't know, Greg. I think you might be looking over my own shoulder and reading my notes, because that leads me to my next question.
Oh, okay.
Which is, do you have any upcoming work in the Civ series that you could inform us of, such as Civilization Revolution? It's the first title to be specifically developed for console platforms like the PlayStation 3 and the Xbox 360.
No, I don't, but I sure would like to.
And we would, too. Hint, hint to people out there.
There you go. I've done a lot of paintings, done a lot of them. And there are ones that stand out in my mind, things that you particularly enjoy. That was one of them, the civilization painting. It just takes me over completely, and I am inside of it so that I'm completely unaware. That, for me, is the ultimate achievement, personally, just for my own personal artistic sensibilities. And that picture did it for me.
So, lastly, is there anything that we have not talked about that you would like to mention or elaborate on something already said?
Again, I just have to say finally that I really enjoyed that painting, enjoyed the process. It's all about the journey to me, and that journey was very enjoyable.
And we can see that in the painting for what we've talked about in terms of the contrast, the light and dark, and the rich colors. We can see the passion that went behind that painting. It wasn't just something that you knocked out in about 60 seconds and didn't think anything of it again. It really captures so much.
Good. I'm glad. I had a friend who plays the game. I showed him the picture. He said, "You play the game?" I said, "No, I don't think about that." He said, "Well, it looks like you play the game." That was the ultimate compliment from my friend.
You should ask your friend if he visits a Polton on a regular basis. No, you don't have to do that.
Okay.
I've been speaking with Greg Hildebrand, fantasy and science fiction artist who drew an exclusive poster that is included in Civilization IV Gold Edition. He and his brother Tim's work are represented exclusively by the Spiderweb Art Gallery in New Jersey. For more on Greg, visit the official Brothers Hildebrand website at brothershildebrand.com. And for more on Civ IV Gold Edition, visit civilization.com. Greg, thank you for taking the time to speak with me.
Well, thank you very much. Nice talking with you. I had fun.
Metropolitan University.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, if people do want to learn how to play Civ better, there is a good way for competitive playing to have other people give you advice.
And we would find that where? Jeez.
Metropolitan.net.
Really?
Forums?
Wow. How can I figure that
out? I don't know.
Metropolitan University. Sometimes I wonder. Derek Kale Paxton, lead on the Civilization IV mod series Fall from Heaven on Modders.
John Kangham was the creator of Might and Magic. And when he first started making it, which I consider the golden age of gaming, he made all of the art, he made all of the music, he did the programming, he did the game design, he would box, he would burn the disc and mail it to you if you ordered the early versions of Might and Magic. I mean, he was involved in every step of the process, and I think that's really amazing that somebody gets to do that, and it's not something that anybody can do anymore. The game development companies are licensing graphics engines, they're getting composers involved to write the music, and we come away with very professional looking products, but we've lost the fact that one person can just decide from end to end what his game looks like. And I think the only people that can do that nowadays are modders, who can take the game engines already there for them and the music and all those working components already there, and then they can do anything they want with them without any kind of requirement.
Canadian themed moments from episode 23. Mark Anderson, Metalliturtle.
That would be me.
Known as Metalliturtle in Canadian slang. Didn't you know?
Sick country you operate, Dan.
From episode 8.
Dan, the computer in a box. I don't think he exists. He lives in Canada. I mean, really, who lives in Canada?
Yeah, I agree.
Not you, fortunately.
He spends all day posting as random Canadians.
Yeah, Canada doesn't really exist. Just Dan sitting in a room with 10 computers, and he's impersonating all the Canadians that exist on the internet.
Only 10 computers, eh, Sabo?
Yeah, anymore, you'd be kind of pushing it. Build, so it's kind of all like...
Yeah, he said he has skills.
From episode 7 with Dan Q, Makalua, Imran, and Anthony Dauphin Christmas.
I've been playing a lot of the Canada mod recently. Surprise! Is that Tundra map?
It's all Tundra. And mountains. And a few forests.
So are you being serious?
Who are you asking?
I would assume a map of Canada would look like that, but then I don't know about Canada. But there really is a Canada mod that he's playing. Who does it replace?
Some nation that I can no longer play. Yes.
Well, that was wrong.
I was trying to cover the fact I didn't pay close enough attention. Okay, you happy now? Now, if you'll excuse me, I need to go get some maple syrup and sit in front of a television to watch a ice hockey game.
And discuss the War of 1812.
And get some coffee from Tim Hortons.
From episode 8.
The shield, or not the hammer.
It's hammer time.
It should always be shields.
Wait, listen. Oh, no, wait, that's vanilla ice.
Dan just showed how white he really was.
Dan's not white, he's black Canadian.
Okay. Whatever that means.
You just made Dan uncomfortable.
He's down with the brown.
Oh.
Well, yeah, actually, UPS is pretty good. UPS, if you would like to sponsor the show. From episode 9. episode 20 with Dan Q, Makalua, Imran, and Ian Oz Hodges.
It's a video about somebody trying to go after Ming, stalking him, and it said, "Ming, you are next," written on the wall in blood. It's about a serial killer.
I guess I'm pretty jaded because I didn't fell for this for one second.
Neither did I. I think Lacutus and I have participated and seen too many April Fool's jokes to really...
Exactly.
Got stiff jump.
How do you like my sip junk?
moving on.
Are you looking at my sip junk?
Moving on.
Hell no.
Bleep, bleep.
Hell no.
Bleep, bleep.
Record date September 1st, 2007. Soundtrack courtesy Civilization IV Warlords and Beyond the Sword. You can access this by MC Hammer Club, copyright Capitol Records. Ice Ice Baby, Clip by Vanilla Ice, copyright SBK Records. Copyright 2007, Apollton Civilization Site at apollton.net.